Clubhouse.
Frisky
Fridays.
Frisky
Fridays in February.
Amp up your romance with Frisky Fridays in February.
Selections from the classics and tried and true favorites.
To brand new binges and sci-fi love stories.
We will have you snuggling on the couch every Friday in February.
Okay. This is Caroline.
And this is Mike. Welcome to Love It or Leave It, Frisky Fridays in February edition. Tonight we're talking about 1942's Casablanca, and to join us, two of our very favorite new friends of the clubhouse, Christy and Leighton from Married MASH. Hey guys, how you doing? Thanks for joining us tonight.
Hey, how are you guys?
So good, and want to know what you guys are drinking.
Leighton has got a little pour here. I'm going to let him go tell you, because I'm actually on water right now. It's kind of early.
On the rocks water, straight up?
Always on the rocks.
On the bottle. I'm drinking actually the Nashville Barrel, or it's from the Nashville Barrel Company, single barrel straight rye. It's 7 year old. Proof's 114. Of course, out of Nashville.
114. Lord, you're going to be soshed by the end of this.
I was going to say.
They drank all the time at Casablanca. What do you mean?
Oh, true. Very true.
I hope you're wearing a tuxedo as well then.
Sure.
Of course, I don't smoke, but. But this company is really good about doing like fundraisers. I think this one was a special forces fundraiser where a group out of Huntsville raised money for like a welcome home party.
That's awesome.
They've got some good stuff. It's just they're not well known.
Well, and Christy and Leighton are fantastic at always giving advice on good whiskey and bourbon drinking. Yes,
we try.
Tell us a little bit about your podcast a little bit, so people know where you're coming from with your Married MASH.
Sure. We are a whiskey tasting podcast. We are a married couple that enjoys partaking in the bourbon and the whiskey drink. And we pick a whiskey once a week and taste it. And we clink it or sink it, whether we like it or dislike it. And we've also incorporated some cooking and cocktails in there. We even have a BS review where we take on the bottom shelf variety and see what we think. And so, yeah, it's kind of morphed into a great little hobby.
It gives me an excuse to buy more.
Yeah, he does that a lot.
It feels like you need an excuse for that. Like, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, so this is our Frisky Friday, and this is at Casablanca. Mike's going to tell us a little bit about what we're doing on this one.
So our Love It or Leave It's typically we look at a movie or a TV show, and you know we invite a panel on. We talk about it. We break down the movie, and then we decide, should we love it or leave it? So for February, we decided to devote every Friday to a different, maybe non-traditional or at least not obvious romantic movie to discuss. So week one, we covered Netflix's Bridgerton. This week, we're covering Casablanca. And then we have WandaVision coming up. And we also have My Best Friend's Wedding coming up later in the month. If we're going to break it down gender roles-wise, we kind of picked two his and two hers movies. This one would be under the his category. So something a little more maybe masculine, a little more swashbuckly. Well, I guess in the case of WandaVision, maybe a little more sci-fi-y. So we're playing with our Love It or Leave It idea for February and calling it Frisky Fridays.
I love that. I love all these movies, so I could talk about all of them.
I know. But this one in particular, what's your, well, Mike, do you want to do the summary?
Sure. Casablanca came out in 1942. It was directed by Michael Curtiz, and it was based on a screenplay by twins Julius J. Epstein and Philip G. Epstein and Howard Koch, who ended up writing. He took the Epsteins originally worked at Warner Brothers and then left to go work on a Frank Capra film. Koch gets picked to write the script. It doesn't get very far. The Epsteins come back after they're done with their other work and basically rewrote the movie. So very little of what Koch actually contributed actually makes it into the final film. But he still gets a writing credit on it, though. It's actually based on an unproduced play called Everybody Comes to Rick's, right. It's actually, I guess, not even really an original story. It's just because the play was never produced. I guess it can count as an original story. Though the Epsteins and Koch get nominated in the Academy Awards for this year, they actually get nominated for adapted screenplay. It's one of the several Academy Awards that this film goes on to win. Interesting was that they actually bought this for $20,000. $20,000 of 1942 money, which was the highest paid amount for an unproduced play script previously. Warner Brothers actually ended up spending a lot of money making this movie. It went over $75,000 over budget even, and was an unusually high amount of money to make this film. The budget was actually pretty large for this film, especially for 1942. And for a movie they thought wasn't going to do very well, but ultimately did, they put a lot of money and time and actors into it. Here, for those that haven't seen this movie, here is the brief summary of what it's about. Casablanca is the story of a cynical expatriate American cafe owner who struggles to decide whether or not to help his former lover and her fugitive husband escape the Nazis in French Morocco. I don't know if that really captures the spirit of Casablanca, but I guess in a one-sentence blurb, it is accurate.
I kind of feel like it's crazy that they bothered to say that it was his former lover right there in the little summary. Like, that's kind of like, you know, a huge twist.
Yeah, is it though? Right? I mean, Bogart and Bergman are just kind of, you know, throwing love daggers at each other as soon as she enters the bar.
You know, something's going on when she comes in,
right? So, Christine Layton, what's y'all's history with Casablanca? Have you seen it before? Was this your first watch?
I've only seen bits and pieces.
Yeah, just those movie shows where they talk about the classics. We've seen snippets and everyone knows the famous lines from the show. But I had always wanted to see this movie. And we have a refurbished theater downtown called the Alabama Theater. And it is beautiful. And they do old movies. They do a Christmas special where you can go in and watch. And they have a player organ that comes up out of the floor and you can sing and whatnot, but they'll host these older movies and it has that old movie theater feel, except you get to have alcohol there. So it's a plus. I've been wanting to go see it in that setting to feel like that old time kind of movie watching. But we have yet to do it. And then COVID hit, and of course, there you go.
Right.
Yeah. But they usually have Casablanca as one of the main ones they feature.
How about you, Mike? Had you seen Casablanca before? Was this your first watch?
No, same as Christine Layton. I was aware of all of the lines. I knew the general story. There's actually a Rick's American, Cafe American, like, named place near where I work, actually. Oh, nice. And so I actually been to a Christmas party actually at that restaurant. Looks nothing like the actual film set, so it's really just the name. I had actually never seen the full movie. This, you know, falls under old movies that Mike hasn't seen. So
bucket list movies. Yeah.
Man, funny. There's so many of them. It's not even a bucket. It's more like a kegger. It's maybe an oil drum. It's an oil drum of movies Mike has never seen. So
we're trying to catch him up with all these different themed Leolis, if you will. Well, I had seen Casablanca before. It's one of those, my kiddos are very interested in movies. So I had pulled up like a movies you must watch by the time you're like X years old. And so it was one of those that was like, hey, even though you guys are kids and stuff, this actually doesn't have sex, swearing, whatever. There's a lot of innuendo, but it's just really a good story overall. Right. So I was excited to get to watch it again.
Well, this movie, interestingly enough, actually originally was going to have a little bit more swearing and a little more sex in it. The Hays Code, which was kind of the self-imposed morality code in Hollywood at the time, prior to the system that took over in the 70s, like the censor code and rating system that we know it, what's known as the Hays Code now, back then, prevented actually a lot of the original sex, at least the sexual references, and even a couple of curse words from coming into it. There were originally explicit references to Rick and Ilsa in the Paris flashback having had sex, and so that had to be removed, and so it's just kind of hinted at and heavily implied. The fact that Renault is trading visa papers for sex with various people, all of that was explicit and had to be removed from the script because of the Hays Code. This is the craziest. This is how far it goes. When Sam is playing, as time goes by, and Rick comes out of his office and he's all hot to trot because the song's being played, the original script had him saying, "Why are you playing like blank that song. And then it turned into, I told you never to play that song, because the pause implied a curse word. So even the implication of a curse word, it had to be changed. It was too hot for hand, you know, too hot to handle for 1942 Hollywood.
What a complete 180 we have done today.
Right? Now we're like, that would be so funny to be like, just the pause, the implication of a swear.
When reading about this film, that they had such wholesome characters, where actually the actors themselves were not so wholesome that time on their personal side of who's with who and all this kind of different thing. So it's kind of interesting they are not quite like their characters.
Like the Brady Bunch?
Oh my God.
Exactly right.
A whole nother podcast there.
Oh my gosh. Well, do you guys have any like familiarity with Humphrey Bogart or Ingrid Bergman? Any of those like kind of like old movie feels for any of them?
I love Bogart. I grew up watching African Queen, so it's weird that I had never seen Casablanca, but African Queen with Katharine Hepburn is just one of my kid movies. I love that movie. So, you know, kind of I knew of him. What about you? Yeah. And Bergman?
No, and I'm not one that loves a ton of different movies. The one character, I don't remember the guy's name. He ends up getting arrested and pulled off. He's got kind of like bulgy eyes.
Oh, yeah. But, Peter Lorre.
Yeah, that's yeah, it.
But I did used to watch a lot of Bugs Bunny, and I remember that character actually was on Bugs Bunny.
we were saying the same thing. Isn't that so funny that we like all know him from Looney Tunes?
You've got to help me escape, Reed.
When I heard his voice, I was like, oh my gosh, that's that one dude.
They actually drew him in the
cartoon.
He ended up being the most pervasive cameo. Because that's how I knew him, and I knew the line, like, Reek, you've got to help me escape, Reek. I knew that all from Looney Tunes, as if, like, the day I had seen it. And so cameo Peter Lorre being used as a scientist called Dr. Lorre goes back to, like, 1946 in Looney Tunes cartoons, but continued all the way up through, like, Tiny Toon Adventures. They were using that Peter Lorre reference. Yeah, really, really funny. Caroline can tell you I've been doing an impression.
Yes, he has been doing that. Reek.
Well.
Yeah.
He did very well.
I mean, just to know that came out in 1946, and I literally can remember it, you know, like it was yesterday. The Looney Tunes were my defining cartoon as a kid, though. I was much more of a Bugs Bunny kid than a Mickey Mouse kid.
Same.
Man, between your Peter Lorre and your Jimmy Stewart, I don't know, Mike. You might have to start like a whole other podcast just for those two.
I know. Well, you know, I have a decent like. Here's looking at you, kid.
Oh, so, look at you pulling out the bogey.
It's not bad.
It's funny you said Jimmy Stewart. There was a quick guy in there. If you didn't catch it, it was very fast. He had one line, but it was the old man Gawa from
the bar or something.
It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh, that's funny.
He was the pharmacist.
Played the pharmacist, but it went through and I was like, oh my gosh, that was old man Gawa.
Yeah, it was.
And he's like, who?
I know who you were talking about after I saw him.
I love that.
But it was really quick. It was really quick.
Look at that, Mike. Crazy, like crossing of paths.
See, that was so we're doing a Christmas podcast right now, Caroline and I, called 52 Weeks of Christmas. The first movie we did the first week of the Christmas podcast was It's a Wonderful Life.
So, it's my favorite.
God, that's crazy.
Yeah, that's a good
one. Well, and neither of us had seen that one. So look at us. We're catching up on all our classics. I know. Yeah, I know. Well, as Mike said, he has a keg of movies he hasn't seen yet.
There
so
you go. You just talked to me. I am a movie whore. I love it, quote it left and right. Ask me a movie. I probably have seen it.
I love that.
I feel like that needs to be a t-shirt we have in the store.
She's a movie whore.
I'm a movie whore.
Yeah.
I'm a movie whore.
I'm thinking
I'm
all
a whore
the people...
for dot, dot, dot. And then on the back, it says movies.
Oh my god!
I would wear it with pride.
We've talked to a lot of cinephiles, but not a movie whore. So that's brand new.
I want to pick up on something that Christy said, because this is a conversation that we were also having before we started recording. You referenced how beautiful Ingrid Bergman is, and I think without a doubt she's quite the dame, but. They portray her in this movie, and if you take a look at the lighting, the way they always put a glow on her face, almost like making her look angelic. Does she come across as the most beautiful woman in the world to everyone here?
I would say
she is attractive, but you're right. They do put kind of the spotlight on her the whole time.
And it's her voice. Her voice makes her, to me, sexy. Not only looking and the outfits they wore, it's just that voice, the accent. accent.
Yeah, I guess she definitely has a sexy vibe, and she has a real ingenue kind of quality about her, especially since she seems so much younger than Bogart and Paul Heinrichs character who plays Victor Laszlo. She seems much younger than either of those guys, so she has a very kind of innocence about her in a sexy way. But it was like, I felt like the movie was really selling us hard on the most beautiful woman in the world kind of quality. And I was like, I don't know. She was what I would call as like handsome today.
And she was fairly a newcomer to Hollywood. They actually had Hedley Lamarr was supposed to be up for that role. And they ended up going with her. And she was kind of unknown at the time, which I thought was interesting that they put her next to Bogart.
I don't think Humphrey Bogart was that good looking.
Well, you know what's so funny about him is that, like, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, this guy must be like in what, like his 50s or something like that, like watching this. And then when they said Rick Blaine, 37, I'm like, 37.
That's what the drinking and the smoking.
The drinking and the smoking, man. Yeah. I mean, that's a very different look. So then I was really trying to figure out how old she's supposed to be. Is she like 20?
I would say she would be in her late 20s, maybe.
You think late 20s?
Maybe early 20s, I would think.
I'm thinking early 20s, too. Which, Laszlo, what's up with you? How old was she then?
Yeah, I'm still thinking about Humphrey Bogart. I was like, he was supposed to be like a sex symbol. He must have been hung like a horse or something.
Oh, God.
Because I was like, he wasn't good looking.
Well, to correspond to that, he wasn't very tall. So did you guys know that, like, she had to, like, she was taller than him. So he had to, like, stand on the old Apple Box business and, like, use the little...
go barefoot in most of her scenes.
Can you imagine that? It's very Tom Cruise. Right?
Yeah. two inches she had on him. So, yeah, you know, and someone with his kind of, you know, street cred, it was all built on. It's the same as, like, Tom Cruise. You know, Tom Cruise is the same height or shorter than, like, all of his, like, opposing ladies, you know, opposite ladies that he acts with. It's a true test of the movie magic to make it look opposite-wise.
Bogart had a ruggedness about him, and he wore that suit well. And I know it to me, it's gross, but back then the manipulating that cigarette, you know, the way the draw to the mouth, take it away, hold the whiskey glass. I mean, he had that tough man, almost mafia like rugged handsomeness.
Got a little swagger.
Yeah, he's not visually like, ooh, but once you start watching his character and his voice, he's got a voice about him. You just kind of go, yeah, I could be with him. Yeah.
Well, it's the same kind of quality that draws so many people to, say, James Bond, right? Especially in the more...
Yeah. I was thinking Roger Moore. He was not that attractive.
Right. Exactly. But there was a swagger about him. There was a man's man quality about him in the same way as kind of Bogart here. You know, not terribly tall. Maybe, you know, looks like he maybe boxed a little too much as a youngster. You know, his face not quite the same position as it was when he was born. You know, all that kind of thing.
Right.
But it gives like a real integrity to it and a toughness to it for sure.
Right.
Which I feel like the character of Rick, like, really needs. Let's dive into some of these individual characters. Do you guys like Rick as a character? Do you feel like you're on his side, or are you just, like, watching his story?
I liked him.
Yeah, I liked him. There was a lot more to the movie, I think, than I thought initially. Yeah,
he had a good plot.
I actually enjoyed him. I still found myself, like, looking at him. You mentioned, like, the smoke of what his suit would have smelled like.
Oh, I know, gosh. We're just non-smokers.
Could you just imagine, though, between, like, the sweat, because you know it's hot, and then the smoking and everything else? Yeah, but, man, dapper suits, man. Walking around in a tuxedo, like, pretty much 90% of the movie. Yeah. Pretty impressive.
You could tell it was not filmed on site.
It was funny, because they were all the ones that got taken, too, when they went around trying to grab people. Everybody in a suit pretty much got grabbed.
Yeah. There you go.
Native American looking, you're out.
You got to round up the usual suspects.
Love it. Mike, how do you feel about Rick? Are you wanting to be Rick? Are you the woman who wants to be with Rick?
Are you asking me personally, do I see myself more as the Rick or as the Laszlo type?
Either one. Yeah, are you more are you more of a Rick or more of a Laszlo?
I think I'm more of a Carl on my best day, you know? I think. But no, I mean, who doesn't want to be Rick, right? The noble guy, the guy who sacrifices his happiness for the greater good in the end, who's aloof. You know, listen, so they show Yvonne, right? And he treats Yvonne kind of like crap and pretends like he's never been with her or whatever. And she's being all clingy and stuff. And he sends her on her way. Like, that's not a great guy. But, you know, I think all guys secretly want to be the one that the woman chases like that in a way.
Oh, you say that, but think about what he said to her when he put her in the cab. You've been drinking too much. You know, he could have taken advantage of her. He sends the bartender, you know, go home. Yeah, but he said, and you come right back. Do nice, not stay. Right? So, I mean, he's kind of a gentleman there.
Well, you're sure. And then Sasha plays that great, too. He's like, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes, you know, sir. Like, ooh, I get to take her home. Well, crap. Okay.
Yeah. Give me an extra 30, boss. But he's a rank sentimentalist, right? I mean, that's what Renault accuses him of. And it's clear that he actually does care for his people, and he goes out of his way to make sure they're safe and taken care of. The way he lets Ugarte in the back room, but not the actual high roller who's a German. He plays the tough guy, but he definitely has his weak spots, his soft spots.
Oh, when he let the couple win on which he knew that 22 would hit, so they could get the money for their papers to be able to get out. That couple, that was like, oh, that's so nice.
When the dealer says, how are we doing otherwise? He's like, well, we're several thousand shorter than I thought we would be, you know, because he has him fix the wheel for a couple rounds.
He's like, yeah, but that's okay. He's like, that's okay.
Leighton, are you a Rick or are you a Laszlo?
I'm actually more like, what was the bartender's name?
Sasha.
Sasha.
Oh, please don't use that name. Not a Sasha. I would think he's more of a Rick. He's rugged.
Well, he owned the bar, no? I mean, come on. Working behind the bar. You're probably owning it.
I don't know, because I'd like to get in on the action stuff.
There you go.
Like flipping the bottles and all that kind of stuff.
Back to our
Tom Cruise. Leighton wants to be Tom Cruise in Cocktail. That's what he's working at the Cell Block. The last bartender poet. That's Leighton's soul right there.
I'm okay with that. The Alabama Slammer.
That would be fun, I think.
Yeah. Leighton putting Christy in a cab and trying to get in there with her. That's what I have an image in my head now.
Well, she got her horse shirt on.
I do remember they mentioned one time they mentioned bourbon.
Oh, yeah. But he said it all funny. He was like, bourbon.
Leighton was losing his mind trying to read the bottles. And what was it? I can't tell. What are they drinking? I can't tell. What are they drinking? I went, probably tea that looks like bourbon.
I love that that's like a whole nother layer for you guys where you would be like trying to peep on the drinks. I love it.
So I think a lot of people end up spending time talking about Bogart and Rick and Ilsa and, as you know, and Ingrid Bergman is Ilsa. But the other top bill, you know, above the, you look at the poster, it's Bergman, it's Bogart, and it's Paul Henreid and Victor Laszlo. And I feel like Laszlo doesn't get a lot of attention and or is problematic or not well-liked or as well-liked as maybe he should be or as the movie portrays him like he should be. What's the problem with Victor Laszlo? Why don't people take to him? How come? I think if you ask most people, they're going to choose to be Rick or be with Rick over Victor Laszlo. Caroline, what's your thoughts on Victor Laszlo?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think you want her to end up being with the man who loves her. And I think he loves the cause more than he loves her. And so I don't know. I feel like there's something to the passion that Rick brings to that little love affair there that makes you feel like you'd rather be with the guy who loves you that hard, that would like let you go, I guess. I don't know. Christy, what do you think? I mean, what's it about Laszlo? Like, why aren't we fawning over him?
When she was with Rick in Paris, she's like, my husband's dead. And I said, that's it. She loved him, I believe, until she met her true love in Rick. But yet honorably, when her husband has not been killed in the concentration camp, that he is alive, that she feels obligated to be with him, but realizes Rick is her true love. It's true because he loves her so much, he's willing to let her go and help her out. So I kind of felt bad for him.
Like, so why don't we love Laszlo, though? Like, why aren't we like, well, it's cool, like, you know, go off with him. Like, because both, I mean, I think we both want her to end up with Rick, right?
Yeah, I kind of did.
I do.
But he's such a good guy.
I think most
guy.
People do. I don't think that's weird. I think that's what you're supposed to feel.
Yeah, Laszlo is such a good guy because of the cause. You know, oh my God, this man survived a concentration camp. He's trying to beat the Nazis. You're like, and Rick is, but he's not. He just doesn't want to be bothered in his business, but he'll help people out on the side. So I do want her to be with Rick, but then I feel bad for Laszlo.
I know.
Because he didn't do anything wrong. You know, he's,
not at all.
He doesn't beat her. He's not a mean guy. He just, they thought he was dead.
I mean, we're setting the bar a little bit low.
I know. I was just going to say, I love that word. Because I'm with you. I'm like, he didn't beat her. So what's up?
He never sets her on fire. Not once.
Yeah, I know.
I wish we knew why they got together to start with. Do you know what I mean? You don't know their backstory.
Yeah. It seemed more like mentor / like she just was like...
She's settled.
Like in awe of him. Like
yeah,
he was
hero
like
worship.
Big, yeah.
A father figure.
Yes.
Kind of, not in a weird way.
No, I think in a weird way, maybe.
Oh,
well,
I think in a weird way. I think it happens often, you know, the hero worship, you know, gets turned into love or the idea, it gets twisted into the idea of love.
Yeah.
Where you love the person for who they are, what they stand for. And that's different than romantic love, but it gets mixed up enough that maybe you don't realize it until it's too late.
There's a difference between loving somebody and being in love with someone. I mean, there's men in my life that I've loved, but I have only fell in love with this man, Leighton, here. I almost feel like this is going to sound really horrible, but I'm going to say it. I think that sex with Laszlo is like, eh. And then maybe sex with Rick is like, oh, I'm mama. You know what I mean?
I think they could have cleared a bar or two. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah. There were some sweaty monkey stuff going on with Rick, where
sweaty
Laszlo was probably...
Stuff is the best monkey stuff.
I know. And Laszlo's probably just missionary, get her done and get her out.
Well, and he's probably preaching virtue the whole time. He's like, you know, he's like, remember the tenets of our cause, like, while he's doing it. Like, you know, doesn't he feel like he's just a little too intense in that department?
A little bit of foreplay. Let's talk about Hitler. All right.
Exactly. Pro or con. Remember, everyone, we're con.
Every punk represents a soul saved.
You know, Rick has to have a 50 Shades room somewhere in that place.
You know he does.
Rick keeps all of his desks and tabletops with bottles on it so he can clear it off in a sweeping motion.
Sweep her off her feet.
He's always ready to throw her up on a tabletop somewhere.
Oh my God.
And they had a song. They had a song together. Yes. If you got a song, then boom.
Which the character Sam gets a lot of play.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the other characters out there. I love Sam, too. I think he's like the best friend we all need. It tells you when to go when you got to go. Tells you, you know, turns the glass over like, I think you're done when you need to be done. Like, he's the guy you need with you to say when it's time to cut bait there, get on out of there.
You know what was my favorite part with Sam was, you know, he'd roll that piano over to whoever he was talking to, and he started to play the song. And then when Rick came out, don't play that song, you know, blah, blah, blah. He just kind of had that look like, oh, shit. And so he just rolled the piano away.
Yes.
Like,
so
I'm out.
Smooth.
I'm out. I'm out in the middle of this. I'm done.
When she comes in, too. Didn't he just?
Oh, his eyes. He knew.
He's like, okay.
But he's great, though. I mean, not only does he earn, he earns all of his accolades in the present scenes, but in the flashback scenes is where I think he really earns his best friend card. You know, just at the train station when the rain is pouring down and the letters literally evaporating, the ink is running off the page in Rick's hand, is a Dear John letter from Ilsa. And, you know, Sam is like, Mr. Richard, we got to go. We got to get on the train, you know. Sam is truly the best friend. I like that he just doesn't play the song when Ilsa comes in and says, you know, play As Time Goes By. And he's like, I don't remember it. And then he starts to play and sing it, Sam. He's like, I don't remember the words, but then he does, you know, because he likes her, but he also knows the pain that she caused him, the heartbreak.
Oh, yeah. He was the one that picked him up.
Yeah.
Right. He has spent this time in between their love affair, like putting Rick back together again. And listen, Rick is the cynic he is now because of that heartbreak. It's the proximate cause of his current cynicism and personality.
Yeah, he seemed different in the pair flashbacks, more Rick at Casablanca was kind of...
Right, he was very open-hearted, it seemed. For whatever the reason is that he has to be an expatriate and can't go back to America, he seemed very happy with his life in Paris. The Rick of in Casablanca years forward is this hard-hearted cynic, and I think that's all formed from the idea of being literally left at the train station.
Yeah.
Or left at the altar.
I mean, practically, because he did propose. Yeah. I mean, he was asking her to get married on the train and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, truly.
And that's where you see that hint of old Rick by helping out the one little couple that needed money and then helping the lady into the cab because she had been drinking too much. And so, you know, that's the little bit of Paris Rick.
Oh, Paris Rick.
Paris. We'll always have Paris. And I found out some interesting things about Sam, the man who played Sam.
Dooley Wilson.
Yes. And what's cool is he was, you know, one of the first African-American actors that was kind of made it big and signed that 7-week contract to play for $500 a week during production. They said it to adjust that, like that he had to give 150 to the studio, but he could keep 350. Like if that was in today's money, he made $5,600 a week, which to me, that's a great number for that back time then. For an African-American actor. However, this is something that Leighton kept fixating on during the movie. He was a drummer. He's a singer, but he did not know how to play the piano.
Oh, tell us. What did you see?
No, he could not play the piano and simply pretended while they had a professional player off camera behind a curtain actually playing.
Oh my gosh.
And you can tell if you look at him.
I mean, he moves his hands across the piano.
Well, the piano's still playing when he's running his hands through his hair, when he's singing a line about having his curly hair, and then the pianist was like, yeah, it was Gene Vincent Plummer was the actual pianist off screen. Yeah, it was a great little side.
I thought that was so funny, and then I read where the piano, there was two pianos used, one that he played in Paris, and then one he played in Casablanca. And at a New York auction in 2012, the Paris piano sold for $600,000, and the piano at Rick's Cafe in Casablanca sold for $3.4 million in 2014.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
It said, curiously, the $4 million the two pianos sold for was four times the budget for the entire production of the 1942 movie.
That's amazing. I would want that in my house, but I would just do the wheeling it around thing. Like I would also not play it right, but I would just be like, I would just come in the room, like on the piano bench, wheeling my piano with me, like everywhere I was going. I'd be like, hello, what are y'all doing in here?
I was referring to it as like, it's like it's the Sam equivalent of like tableside guac, you know, like a Mexican restaurant. He does like tableside pianoing. So.
Yeah.
I loved all these side characters. I loved Carl so much. I thought he was like a fantastic like little extra that you totally knew him, like when he was grinning with the couple, you know, when he was watching Rick actually help that couple, and he was just grinning so big, and just every little part that he played was like just adorable. I loved him.
I mean, every side character felt really lived in. I mean, even like Ferrari, the fat hypocrite. He's like the other really major bad guy besides Strasser. Because I don't think Renault really counts as a bad guy. He's one of those great characters who's a little too opportunistic to be really well-liked, but in the end does the right thing. Ferrari is, you know, kind of a bad guy. But you know him, though, right? You have such a good sense of who he is. Sasha, who we've spent probably more time than anyone in the history talking about Sasha already in this. I mean, he only has three lines in the movie, but they're memorable lines. Claude Rains's Louis Renault.
Okay, so we were watching it, and the way he commented and a little bit of his mannerism, I looked at it late and I said, I think he wants to sleep with Rick.
Yeah. I'm not so sure about him being French. He might be a little more Swedish.
I think he would be with anyone, you guys.
Isn't he the one who says that if he was a woman, he would for surely be in love with Rick?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
exactly. The moment he said that, I looked at Leighton and I said,
there's a couple other comments, too. I wish I would have wrote him down.
But you know what? He's that type of person also that's just like oozing that like wanting to have sex and wanting to be with people that, again, like I do think he probably had more than one person in bed at the same time. And
right?
Yeah. Everyone remembers like the Calvin Klein commercials. Am I touching her or is she touching me? You know, somebody tells me that was probably his like everyday life. I mean, listen, I mean, let's be frank. He was fucking whoever needed a visa. He was getting some on the side.
Yeah. He was a little comedy relief.
He was comedy relief, but he was also kind of a narrator too, right? He was doing a lot of the exposition for us as the audience about who Rick was. Right. If you think about, he's the one who's always telling people about Rick or observing that Rick doesn't drink with the customers. He doesn't accept gifts from the customers. You know, he's the one telling Strasser everything he needs to know, but also telling us. So he actually is playing a little bit Greek chorus, a little bit of omniscient narrator for the movie also. Yeah. And the one calling it like it is. He's the one at the very beginning of the movie who calls Rick out for being, you know, a squishy heart underneath his hard exterior. And in the end is proven right. So
I liked him. I think he's a sass man. And yeah, who doesn't need like the sass character? You need someone on the side, like just being like, "Oh yeah, really? Oh, look what you're doing now!" Like, I love that guy.
He was very funny.
So this movie was actually filmed basically, other than the opening shot of the plane that takes place in that took place at the Van Nuys Airport. This movie was fully shot on studio stages in Burbank at Warner Brothers lot. But does it transport you? Do you feel like you're in a tropical desert Moroccan location here? What does the aesthetic of the film do for you? Is that part of why it's so beloved?
Well, okay. We read a bunch of stuff prior, so I wish I'd waited until after we watched the movie before I read some of the things. It doesn't matter of a set. I can get into a movie even if the set's kind of cheesy when it's an older movie and you can tell it's fake. You know, when they're driving down the French countryside and you know it's a screen behind them, that it's not really a French countryside. But there was a snippet in one of our things we read about the budget got kind of hit because of wartime. And so one of the final scenes where they're in front of a plane, the plane is actually cardboard and they hired little people to prepare the airplane for takeoff. So it looks bigger to scale than it actually was.
I read that too. That is so freaking crazy. But
I'm like, what?
But you know what? But Mike, doesn't that remind you of when we covered Elf, using those practical effects of using people who would be shorter to create a different effect? Like, I really love practical effects. Like, I love that so much more than computer animated or adding in extra stuff. Like, I really love it when they play with those optics. So, I'm amazed when they can do that.
Anyone who's ever been to Disney World or Disneyland and been wowed by the sets and how large and lifelike they are, you know, you've been taken in by the effect of forced perspective and the optical illusion, you know. So I love that that's how they got around a really real problem, that by using, you know, the little people and making it seem like it was larger than it actually appeared. What a great solution. There's a couple of like good solutions like that in this movie. But I think there's something to the fact that if this was set in, say, Sheboygan or Pittsburgh or, you know, Trenton, you know, I don't think it has the same kind of, I don't think it has the same kind of magical effect.
It has this exoticness to it. Like, I've never been to Morocco. I've never considered going to Morocco. Like, I really feel like it's just like this far off place that's just like where, in one way, Rick goes where he thinks no one will ever find him again. He's just like off the grid kind of thing. But then at the same time, it's like this romantic, or maybe romanticized, because not really. When you really look around, people are feverishly, you know, seeking to get out of there. So it's not really romantic, but there's this like feel of just like history and mysteriousness.
Yeah, intrigue and, like you said, mystery.
Right, because it's not a world you know. Right. It's not predictable. It seems like it's a lot of what pulls people into like the Indiana Jones movies. Right. And when they're on set, when they're on location in the Indiana Jones movies in some kind of small village or, you know, and there's people speaking foreign languages and it just feels so foreign and exotic. It feels like there's danger and excitement and mystery around every corner. This movie hits a lot of different kind of genres, and the film noir aspect of it, the dark shadows, the spotlight that's always chasing around and, you know, going by Rick's Cafe, all of that goes towards this. You don't know what's going to happen when you go in, when you enter a room, you don't know who might be in there waiting for you.
Danger, espionage.
Right.
Getting your papers in order.
Yeah, and people like coming and going all the time, you know, it being this place where these people, you truly don't know who's going to be in the next room or who's showing up on the next plane or who's gone forever.
Or will you get taken when the Nazis come in to clean house?
Although it does seem like everybody knows everybody. It's kind of like Cheers.
It kind of is. Well, it's like a little big town, right?
Right, well, that's what Regault says to Strasser. Like, they didn't need to worry about going to find the murderer too fast.
They were coming to them,
because everyone goes to Rick's, everyone comes to Rick's in the end.
I love that. What do you guys think about where it's like set like in history, this like super tension filled dangerous, fearful time for the world?
It's interesting. I'm actually reading a book about Hedy Lamarr, who actually, she was more of a scientist than an actress, or she did it on the side. And she fled Austria to America to get away from all that and then felt guilty. But was at meetings with Hitler and knew the plan and kept it to herself till she got over here. And so that whole Nazism, the worst of the worst. The ultimate bad guy in Hitler plays really well in movies in that era, like the Indiana Jones, they're fighting the Nazis and stuff. It's just the ultimate bad guy and the ultimate, like, if you get caught by them, you're done.
Yeah. I mean, it like absolutely heightens the stakes for everything. Like if everything's live and die kind of moment.
We were able to go, my daughter, youngest, and I were able to go on a tour last summer to Europe, right? And did a World War II tour. So like we started in London and then went into Paris and we were moving along like we were storming the history. You know, we were following the history. We were actually there for the 75th D-Day celebration and went into Belgium, went into Germany and then Austria. This movie and like the book I'm reading, I just love that point in history. Not love as in ooh, but it's so fascinating how all of that took place and people just ignored what was happening. And the next thing you know, 6 million people are murdered. It's interesting to have that scene and that set on any kind of movies.
It is a fascinating time in history. And like you said, there's some part of it that's like, it seems so unbelievable. Like there's no way that someone could just march through all these countries like,
yeah.
And no one would notice and no one would stand up and like, what? Yeah. Like this doesn't make any sense, you know?
We actually got to go to a concentration camp in Munich. We went to Dachau and I was glad my daughter was with me because she needed to see it. I mean, we stood in front of the crematoriums. They had pictures of how all of that took place and how the town just ignored the smell, ignored what was going on, ignored it. But now that city is so, like they had the Olympics there at one time in Munich and the top of their stadium is plexiglass. They were like, we want to be transparent. We are ashamed of that time. We don't want it to happen again. They have signs up at the concentration camp that say never again in several different languages. So whoever comes there reads it. They turned Hitler's office there in Munich into a jazz history museum, a musical museum, because he hated jazz. So I'm like, that's an ultimate slap in the face that his old offices are now a jazz history and a school there.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's just, yeah, like, you know, screw you, you know?
Yeah.
Because he got rid of it. He hated jazz. He got rid of it.
Y'all didn't know it was going to get that deep, did you?
I knew nothing about Hitler's jazz aversion. I knew nothing.
Yeah.
Mike, you're a history buff. I mean, what does this speak to you?
I love it. I mean, I like how, because it's set in a really interesting point too, because it's after the war started, but it's before America's entered the war. And, you know, I was reading about how the screenwriters actually put it before the bombing of Pearl Harbor, because they felt without America in the war, where America was still playing the isolationist country, it reflected or informed Rick's behavior and the choices that he makes also, where he has to eventually end up picking a side and coming out as picking a side and kind of stop playing, you know, stop sitting it out and sitting kind of above it like he is in the beginning of the movie. And ultimately he does choose a side and he comes out and he chooses the cause and Victor and Ilsa. And I think that probably would have been lost. Maybe the stakes would have been lost. I think the whole vibe of the movie would have been different had it been post-America entering the war. Because I think it was so dire prior to that, right? I mean, the idea England was, you know, basically about to fall before D-Day. The bombing from the Luftwaffe was just, you know, England was just on the verge of collapse, and they were the last stronghold without America in the war. So it's a really interesting time to set it. And for the movie to come out so fast, I mean, the movie comes out in 1942, just a year after the United States enters the war, I think is interesting because it's rare you get a wartime movie made and released during the war itself talking about. And so it was very real for all these people. You read about the cast, the background actors, so many of them were Jews that had fled Nazi Germany. Like these were people who had actually lived,
who had lived
the atrocities, right? Strasser, the actor who plays Strasser, Konrad Veidt, he was actually a refugee German who had fled Nazi Germany because his wife was Jewish. And he ends up playing Nazis in a lot of his roles and is playing the Nazi in this movie. But imagine, though, like it's one thing that we're this year will be 20 years on from 9/11. But imagine a movie coming out about 9/11 within months of 9/11 happening. Very different, very difficult, very, very topical. It makes the film very political, actually, in a way that we probably don't appreciate today. You know, we look at this film now, we're like, oh, Bogart, Bergman, the quotes, the smoking, the drinking, you know, the implied sex. But this movie is extremely political for its time and when it comes out.
Yeah. Pick a cause.
Well, and I think that it also, like, and I have not researched this portion, but just in listening to you guys talk about it, it made me realize, you know, how much an audience would actually be encouraging of Laszlo to get to America, because you have to think that he was going to raise the awareness and say, look what's happening, look what's going on, you guys, you need to get involved in the war. And so there's something about it that actually feels like I get Rick better than I ever did before. Before it was just like, wow, okay, so he said, go with your husband, that kind of thing. But I didn't take it from that political standpoint of like, oh no, it's much more like you need to go tell America, you need to go spread your message so that they get involved.
Been there, done that, seen it. What's going on? Yeah. What would have been different?
It also informs some of the plot too, especially in the early part of the movie when Victor and Ilsa first show up and Strasser, who is this Nazi who is just visiting Casablanca, doesn't really have any power, but he definitely holds sway and he holds influence. And you're kind of asking yourself, like, why? And Victor talks often about how this is unoccupied France. This is not Vichy France. And a lot of that probably flies over our head, but that's all very real important stuff for that time. Mm-hmm. The idea that there was French resistance, that there were French territories not under control of the Germans. The flashback, the idea of watching the Germans roll into Paris. Now, that's stock footage of Paris. A lot of that is stock footage of Paris that they use in the movie. Mm-hmm. Again, it's so fresh when this movie comes out in the memories of those making it, those living it, those going to see it. I think this film must have been very powerful and very emotional to go watch it at the time in the theaters.
Yeah, not being able to, like, social media, we can see whatever we want to see right now. You Google it, you can see it. And then they didn't have television. So they got a lot of their things from the movies. And when you would go see a movie, that's when you would see the newsreel of actual footage of stuff. So you may not have been known how bad it was until you went to the movies just to see this. And I'm sure the preview before this was a newsreel about what was going on.
Oh yeah, no, for sure. I mean, what a weird thing. You're probably getting some kind of war update in the newsreel and then going and sitting and watching this movie, this fictional account of this thing happening overseas in this foreign place that's not hitting the headline. So this movie actually was originally supposed to be released in early January in early 1943. Eventually it got pushed up to a New York release in November of 1942 because they wanted to capitalize, Warner Brothers wanted to capitalize on the Allied forces' recent invasion of North Africa, opening that front of the war. So they wanted to capitalize on that. And so they pushed up the release date. But again, think about that. Casablanca sits in the northern part of Africa. That was just happening. You know, I think it was 6 weeks. This movie comes out in New York, and the November release date is in New York at the Hollywood Theater. Just, I think, 6 weeks after the Allied invasion of North Africa. It's almost real time. It almost feels like like a documentary, you know, in some ways, you know, especially the way they show like the Underground Railroad kind of, maps and stuff at the beginning of the movie. It's really kind of fascinating when you think of it as a historical piece.
Wow. New perspective.
Yeah. I know. Right. And yeah, I'm like, my mind's sitting here thinking we picked this for Frisky Friday. Like super funny. But I mean, there is that romantic element to this, you know, everything that's going on between Rick and Ilsa and just the entire, giving up your individual wants for this greater good. There's romance to that, right?
It is. And I just didn't think when you were saying let him go to America to let them know what's going on, I didn't really think about that side of it. I just thought he was, you know, I love you so much, you need to be with this man. But for him to get away was actually maybe more important than them being together.
Well, that's what that problems of three people doesn't amount to a hill of beans when we've got all this going on. It's sort of like we can't be bogged into this, to our relationships. Like Laszlo's got to go, right? Laszlo's got to go and you've got to help him get this message, you know, elsewhere. And it does. I do feel like in just talking about this, I'm like, damn, you guys, this is a heavy, important movie that we need to learn. We started off with like, who you want to sleep with, Rick or Laszlo?
Yeah. And now we're like, whoa, that's deep.
And we're like, did you get the map I sent you so that we can?
Listen, we y'all have to fuck Laszlo for the greater good.
We all do.
Yes. Listen, I mean, you know, Leighton, you know, saddle up, buddy. You got to do what you got to do for a cause.
Oh my god, don't worry. He's just gonna read out of his books while it's happening.
He won't even be present. You can really just fiddle about whatever you need to do.
Can I have a shot of whiskey first?
There you go. Yeah, several. No,
maybe a couple. Maybe a whole bottle.
Bourbon, like that. That's so wild.
Sasha, set up the bourbon. I got to go fuck Laszlo. So for me, the romance of this movie, yes, this is a very romantic story, and I'm happy we picked this for Frisky Friday. And I think the best expression of it, I think where you feel the heartstrings pull at you most is with the soundtrack of the movie. You know, when you think about the score, you think about the As Time Goes By being played, explicitly being played, and the way it transports Rick in his drunken stupor into his flashback, and we see him and Ilsa and their fling in Paris, which set off everything Rick would become. All of that together, I think, is really what frames this as a romance we can all kind of identify parts with. The idea of love had and love lost, or love, you know, the all the gin joints she walks into mind, the idea of had just gotten over you and now you're back in my life. Or maybe you identify with the idea of we can't be together for reasons beyond our control. I think there's a lot of different aspects here that many people can identify with, at least on some level. But the music for me is what frames all of that. Is this something you guys took note of watching it? Did the music play a big role for you? Caroline, I'll want to take this to you.
I was singing along with Babyface, and it had to be you. Like, I was singing along with those because I'm like, I know this, and that's crazy that this is like still around, you know, because there's not that many. You know, we put on music for my grandma, who's like 95, and we'll put on stuff and we'll be like, put on the kind of music grandma likes, and it's from like this era, and now it's like, oh wow, like a lot of these songs actually come from this movie, or at least this movie really highlighted enough that it became more popular. And so, yeah, I love them. How about you guys?
I'm, what is it? If I just said I was a movie whore.
Yeah, she likes all that.
I'm a music whore as well. So I'm relate to Rick when the music starts and he just goes right back to Paris.
When there's something interesting, was it the As Time Goes By? It was like written years before. And like today, a lot of them are written for movies and stuff, but it wasn't the case.
Yeah, it was written for a 1931 musical, a Broadway show, but ended up not getting used. Fascinating, Max Steiner, who is one of the early legends of soundtrack scores, who did the score for this movie, actually hated As Time Goes By and wanted to replace it with his own composition. He wanted it out of the movie entirely.
Max.
Here's the thing.
So it turned out, but just by fluke, if they were to do that, and the studio was going to let him do that, Ingrid Bergman had already cut her hair getting ready for her next role. I think it was for Who the Bells Toll. She had already cut her hair. Yep. She had moved on, getting ready for the next. So they couldn't bring her back to refilm the scenes. They'd have to refilm to account for the different song being used. And so Steiner got stuck. And so he ended up having to use it, because if you listen to the orchestral score, As Time Goes By is one of the main recurring motifs of the score. You'll hear the chords of it throughout orchestral part. And so he was forced to use it against his will. And it wasn't like a year later, he gives an interview. He's like, I still hate the song, but I guess enough people like it. There's something about it that people like, but real dismissive, even still, even after it became such a trademark of this film, Steiner was like a real little bitch about it. Like, just never warm to it. It was, you know, one of those things where like a real artist having to be, you know, have to turn up his nose and go to work kind of thing. It's just an interesting little thought. Like, can you imagine this with some other song other than As Time Goes By and what that's become culturally?
Well, that's just all about movies. That sometimes if you were watching a scary movie and there's no music, the music helps that that build up. So the romance, you needed that song. You felt their love through that song.
What about Jaws?
Yeah.
Go to YouTube and look up Star Wars, the original Star Wars. There's a scene of the medal ceremony that you can find without the score, without John Williams' score. And it is the most uncomfortable, awkward,
well, there's all just like looking sounding. At one another. Like it's
and
like...
it's just like random coughing, like and just kind of like grunting. And then the R2 makes his like R2 beep boops, but it's like out of context because there's no music. So just randomly it's like beep boop beep boop, and it's so awkward. And then it's moments like that you realize how important score is. And Steiner was great. I mean, Steiner did King Kong, he did Gone with the Wind. Max Steiner is truly one of the original great of the talkie era soundtrack scorers. Really classic. He doesn't get enough credit, but the idea that he was so against As Time Goes By, the pop song, that he would have removed it and it wouldn't have been part of the orchestral song and music is wild to me.
Really? You can't? Really?
You know what, you know, Sam? Don't play it again.
Don't ever play it again. Shut the hell up.
Were you guys shocked that that's actually not uttered in the movie? This is one of those great things.
Shut the hell up?
Right. Play it again, Sam.
Oh, yeah. Shut your pie hole, Sam. Well, no.
He didn't say it. She actually did.
Well, no, nobody says play it again.
No one actually says
Sam.
The word, but she's actually the one that kind of references the...
Well, she says...
Play it, Sam.
Play it, Sam. Yeah. Play as time goes by. Yeah. Nobody says play it again,
that's
Sam.
That's what I mean. She's the actual one, because I always thought it was him. The one that.
Well, so she says it there, and then he comes out and after the bar closes, and Sam's like, I'm not going anywhere if you're not going. And so he undoes his, you know, he undoes his bench, and he rolls the piano over to where Rick is drinking, and he says, play it. Play As Time Goes By, Sam. You played it for her. You can play it. You can play it for me, he says to her. But yeah, he never says play it again, Sam. Yeah, it's one of the most famous lines for the movie ever spoken. A great little thing.
It really gives the show, though, how stuff can be mistaken and then...
The Mandela effect.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Freaky.
It is crazy.
See, look, without that music, is Twilight Zone anything? No.
No, it's a weird man standing there.
Exactly.
Yeah, could you all imagine spending a weekend with Rod Serling? What a weird, wild time that would have been.
That
guy was a freak and a half.
Oof. Right?
I don't know why I was going to do another Rick, you've got to help me escape. I feel like that's what hanging out with Rod Serling must have been like.
Oh my god.
This is the part, so we've talked about the movie. I think we've all kind of shaped our opinions. I have a good idea where we're all coming from, but it's now time for us, all of us, to say whether or not we love it or we'll leave it. As you guys are our guests, we're going to go to Christy and Leighton first. Christy, do you love it or leave it?
Well, I think you can tell that I love it, love it. I want to watch it again now and rewatch it.
So are you saying you're a Casablanca whore?
I would. Yes, it goes into my whoredom of movies of that I love.
So
movies and music.
Movies and music.
Eminem.
So I can't say I like it.
No, you could. You could say that you have your reservations about it. You could say.
And this is why. I mean, I enjoyed watching it.
You better. It was our date night.
Yeah, but what's crazy with the stuff that I kind of like would be like if Underworld came on and Casablanca's on, I'm probably going to the Underworld.
So and that's why we have two TVs.
Oh my gosh. Maybe. But if it is a date night and you know you have to pick a romantic movie, are you okay with Casablanca being a choice versus,
totally,
a rom-com from, you know, last year?
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah.
How about you, Mike? How do you feel about this one?
Oh, I love it. I love it. It was better than I thought it would be. It was a much more complex movie than I thought it was. Yeah. There was a lot more substance and meat here. I kind of like Leighton just said, I assumed that this would have been a movie I would watch one time and then I would never have to worry about watching it again. But I would watch this again. I've actually now watched it twice and I would definitely watch it again. I think there's actually probably a lot there. There's probably a lot of substance there to even pick up on multiple viewings. But there are so many classic, things that come out of this. I want to rewatch it again just to pick up all of the cultural...
Yeah, I agree.
All of the cultural tangents that have come out of this movie, all the tropes that have come out of this movie. How about you, Caroline?
I'm a lover of it. I'm a lover, but everyone knows on this podcast I'm a lover of it all.
So you're a movie whore.
I am. I was gonna say maybe movie slut. I don't know. I'll come up with something. But for sure, maybe film slut is my word.
Jane, you movie slut.
Exactly. There you go. I mean, mean, I think that the dialogue is unbeatable in this one. I mean, but the round up the usual suspects, I did not know that it even came from this. I feel like Play It Again, Sam, even though it wasn't in there, I feel like we say it all the time. Here's looking at you, kid. I mean, come on, guys. Like, there's
it's
like the most quoted movie.
We'll always have Paris.
Yes. And I mean, that means like everything. And of course, I'm not even going to attempt the gin joint line, but if that is not the most, like, I can't believe you drug your ass in here after everything that has happened, kind of line.
All the gin joints and all of the towns and all the world, she walks into mine.
There you go, that's Christy.
My favorite line from the movie was, I'm a drunkard. I like that
Yes, yes. So they're like, where are you? Yes, like, what's your nationality? I loved it. But there was, like, zingers left and right, which I just appreciate so much. And the acting was great, because I think that there's movies of this era that are so hammy and so where the women are all like, meh, meh, meh. You know, they have this, like, kind of, yeah, it's just so, like, mushy feeling. Nothing feels like it's actual, genuinely sincere. I felt that Rick was brokenhearted, and he did that without being like sort of just this sentimental fool, you know.
Right.
I still thought he was a rugged man, and he had tears in his eyes.
Yeah. Right.
That's hard to do, you guys, and they pulled it off.
I think a lot of it too, and I think the humor, the much funnier movie than I thought it would be, the quips, I think a lot of that, the pacing's really fast. This is an hour and 40 minute movie that doesn't feel like an hour and 40 minutes. It goes by pretty fast. I think the editing in this movie is really crisp and makes it move along really well. And even with the sentimental scenes, you never get bogged down in the in the mushiness of it, right? He's a man with tears in his eyes, but he's a goddamn man. And I think a lot of that is the pacing of it. He's not moony faced, you know, for 10 minutes before he goes to his flashback in Paris. It happens quick, you know. It just kind of moves along.
He gets in, he gets out.
Yeah.
Right. That's what she said.
I like that even like the sadness and stuff is told through some of the other characters. Like Sam's concern for Rick tells me how sad Rick really was when this all happened. But right. I don't have to see it. It's just the concern, the like, oh shit, get out of here, Elsa. Please just get out of here.
Yeah,
like,
no, that idea tells what this man's me. Been through.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, watching Carl or watching Renault react to Rick do things that he doesn't normally do, sit down with customers. You know, there must be something about this Laszlo and this woman, this most beautiful woman he's with, because Rick doesn't sit with his customers or he's sitting with them. You know, he doesn't take drinks, he doesn't accept gifts, but he's doing it here. You know, watching them react to him doing things means a lot, because they're telling us this is weird. He's acting differently now all of a sudden. Just a little last fact for you, mentioned the screenplay, Caroline.
Yeah.
2006, the Writers Guild of America named this the best screenplay ever.
Wow. Nice. That's impressive.
Well, yeah.
Look at me calling out the dialogue.
Good job.
Oh, my gosh. Right? Pat on my back. I'm the film slut up in here.
Christy Layton, guys, thank you so much for coming out and spending Frisky Friday with us and talking about Casablanca. We hope you guys enjoyed yourself.
Yeah, we did. Thanks for having us.
It's a movie where a man's man can have tears in his eye, and we still want to sleep with him, you guys.
Yeah. And the guys want to have a
But you got
to
fuck Laszlo for the cause. Why are we forgetting that?
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my
anything
gosh.
For the cause.
Oh, gosh.
He has a scar on his face. He's rugged.
Yeah,
he's a little bit like George Lazenby, right? If to Sean Connery's James Bond, Laszlo's kind of like the George Lazenby James Bond, you know. But you know, he still has sex. So,
Christy and Layton, where can people find you guys? Where can they listen to Married Mash?
Oh gosh, we're on most places where you listen to a podcast. We're an Anchor podcast, but you can listen to us at Spotify, iHeartRadio. We're out and about out there. Absolutely. So we have a Linktree site if you want to go there and find us on social media or our Patreon page. It's linktr.ee/MarriedMashPod. Check it off.
Fantastic. Well, thanks you guys so much for listening. This is Caroline.
And this is Mike. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Love It or Leave It and all of Pod Clubhouse's podcasts at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you could leave us a 5-star rating, that would be great.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.